Being the hearing. Mr. Barrow, just before we left you, I asked you to look at policy 6322 in relation to this provision 6412. Does policy 6322 mean that in the residential zones, for example, there could be some discretion as to the application of the landscape provisions? Because I noticed that in some parts of the mapping, the ONL lines wander into the residential zones, places where the urban growth boundaries and the ONL lines are close, sometimes they wander into the urban area. Is that the intention?
No, the intent of that policy, which is located under the objective for cumulative adverse effects, is on rural living opportunities, or opportunities for residential development in the rural zone. With regard to the location of the landscape line as proposed, and urban zoning and the urban growth boundary locations.
I don't mind interrupting you there and saying, well, is there maybe a way that policy could be better worded to get that intention across, if that's what was intended?
Make it specific to the zone, to the area that's contemplated.
And would that just be the rural zone?
No, it would be the three rural zones. And it.
Which three?
Sorry, sir.
No, I can't.
The rural lifestyle zone and the rural residential zone. So
Gibson.
The,
Gibson.
Gibson character zone. And any special zone or resort zone that's located.
So we're getting quite broad.
We're getting quite broad, but going back to your first question about the residential urban zones.
So why not just do it by exclusion of residential zones rather than inclusion of others? Would that not be more clear?
I'm not
except
sure.
In the residential zones?
Just depends where it's going, Commissioner Gilmore. There's a danger with excluding things that one's missed out. But exploring that issue further, it could be disregarded where the urban growth boundary, in the context of the urban growth boundary, could be a more efficient way to.
Right, okay,
but what about the townships?
That's right. Well, the townships, you're right, there's no urban growth boundaries for them. There is for Riverside and the
that's
township down in Monaco.
So there's
none at Harware, there's none at Kingston, Glenorchy.
So that's right, I'd be reluctant to come up with an anecdote on the hoof, but I understand that.
You might like to put your mind to that.
Thanks,
and happy for you to come back to us on that one, because I think it is quite important, because I think some of the submissions might have be a result of reading that as having wider application than what your intention is.
No, I prefer not to discuss the specific location of the landscape line relative to other mapping annotations.
No, that's not. just for example, you?
Yes, thank you. There has been quite a lot of discussion about how to include the capacity for primary regional infrastructure to be to go ahead in areas. Have you got any comments to make about suggested changes for the use of inappropriate or mitigate remedy and what other impacts that might have?
Sorry, Commissioner, can we also have the topics to do
so
with
in terms of ONRs and ONFs asking for allowing, putting the word inappropriate development uses.
Did you say regionally significant infrastructure?
And that was one of them, but then we were looking at there were also, for instance, gondolas. There were others also who submitted that the word inappropriate should be included to broaden the scope. The main ones were infrastructure, but there were also some.
Yes, in context of submissions.
Yes, sorry, just in terms of submissions. So, just in terms of your response to that kind of wording, whether it would be too broad, perhaps.
Could you direct me to the provisions in the landscape chapter that raise this or that are most highlighted to you in this issue?
Sorry, I'll have
631.12.
Well, 631.12 is the new, a revised recommended policy to acknowledge the location constraints and the importance of regionally significant infrastructure. Was Commissioner Gilmore asking about infrastructure generally in the
Sorry, Mr. Barr. I think, are we referring to your version or the notified version?
I'll be referring to my version right now. In this context, I'd be referring to Appendix 1 of my officer's report. And before I
asked that question to make it clear that the not a revised version, it's only your version.
Yes,
for the public and fellow commissioners.
And Commissioner Gilmore.
So you feel that your suggestion and your revised is adequately enabling for regional infrastructure, but not ensuring that there will not be other unintended adverse effects from as yet unknown suggested uses.
Yes, in the context of the recommended policy, 631.12, it acknowledges that there are location constraints. It also acknowledges the legacy of the location of some infrastructure, such as where the national grid is. It certainly reluctant to accept any modifications that would make it enabling or provided for. This is the landscape chapter. Its function is to manage that resource.
Commissioner Gilmore, just while we're on that one, Commissioner Robinson and I had in terms of the, while acknowledging the location restraints.
Have you turned your microphone?
Oh, probably not. No.
Just in terms of where it says, while acknowledging location restraints, what course of action do you envisage is considered when you're acknowledging the location restraints?
Well, any modification or improvements to the national grid where it travels through this district would clearly be in an ONL because it's coming from the central Otago district through the Kawerau Gorge. That's an acknowledgement of its.
But as regionally significant infrastructures currently identified in Chapter 3, it seems that there could be quite a wide range of things that are considered to be regionally significant infrastructure, which could be right through to overhead power lines for distribution rather than transmission, or for telecommunication facilities or networks. Right. Given that definition and location restraints in a landscape area, do you see any potential issues that might arise out of that?
There is the potential. I think what we need to do instead of perhaps focusing on that policy would be to seek further refinement or clarification in the definition. And the other, I'm just looking at the definition, sir, and Mr. Pates' report. C of the proposed definition, recommended definition, does, you know, says telecommunication and radio communication facilities. That policy, that recommended policy, doesn't flow on to any specific dispensation or development right in terms of the activity status of rules more than what has been notified in the proposed district plan. The policy would need to be contemplated with the other policies, so it's certainly not an out, and while there's the potential, I certainly don't see it as a clear unintended consequence for, you know, even upgrading it. Things that are debated whether or not they're significant is the thing included.
Even for things such as a brand new cell site, radio communication site?
It would have to be viewed in the context of the respective rules in that chapter for the NES, if it's applicable. And if the impacts were of such a, it would come back to the status of that activity in terms of the rules, and then it would obviously, if the district-wide higher order framework needed to be contemplated, then that would be one of the provisions that would need consideration.
Thank you.
Can I just follow up on that? The point I was going to put to you on the detailed provisions while it's fresh in your mind is saying while acknowledging location constraints doesn't tell me what form, what the result of that acknowledgement is. Does that mean you acknowledge them and say, well, that's tough, or you acknowledge them and say, well, that means it has to go there, or is it something in between? And if it's something in between, what is that?
I think it is something in between, sir. I think it's a case of saying, you know, there's other resources at stake here, despite the overwhelming need for this infrastructure. That was the context. But it's also, there's also synthetic elements to it as well. I wouldn't be I'd be reluctant to add any further qualifiers to it because I wouldn't want to lean in either direction. I think that it's important. I think that it's helpful that it's there, people contemplating that, but I think it could go both ways, and that's simply a case of the location it's in.
Can I ask a further question on that? Looking at an example that's been in media lately, if it were a new one, and Ladies Mile Trees, and that was considered regionally important infrastructure, would that be allowed under this, or would it be, no, that's a scenic corridor, it's got Fergus Medulla. So there isn't really any guidance in that.
No, but if you provided guidance, you might dedicate a few pages to do so. I mean, initially your guidance would be in the lower order provisions.
Does it need approval?
What's the activity status? And if the activity status is something that the plan doesn't contemplate, or contemplates that it's an issue, perhaps a discretionary or non-compliant status, then perhaps you'd turn your mind to the higher order framework.
Just a more of a general one, and you may have explained it in your report, but we had obviously a submission we had to hear from Upper Cliff Environmental Society tomorrow. Just around the issue of what the bottom went out, apparently the society referred to some draft documents, and then it was changed when the notified version. One of the ones that jumps out was the one part you're talking about non complying for activities for a zone that was back to discretionary. Could you explain what the process was?
Yeah. Happy to tell you the story on that, sir. So the provisions that were worked up in 2014 had a non complying activity status. Available for inspection, but essentially the policy framework and the rule framework was essentially the same, except as a non-complying status for subdivision and development in the ONL and ONF. The rule that when that package of documents went to council for endorsement in December, it was rejected on the basis that there hadn't been enough consultation undertaken, and that was one of the issues which I suspect got people's alarm bells going, and perhaps they contacted some Liquid members. Perhaps they gave a public submission at the council meeting. So we were instructed to undertake further consultation. So we undertook consultation in January to March 2015. We got feedback from about 40 groups or individuals, and the overwhelming response was that the discretionary regime should stay. And I'm comfortable with that because I think that there are enough tools in the proposed plan to manage the potential impacts. One of the reasons for also changing it back to discretionary was that there, as Dr. Reed alluded to on Monday, is that there are sometimes some instances in this district it's what part of the rural zone is not ONL. And there are working farms that are entirely located within the ONL, and those landowners were quite vocal in saying that it would be near whether it be deception. And to be honest, a layperson's view of how the non-complying versus discretionary standards. But it was their perception that would just make it very difficult to undertake farming on a day-to-day basis or provide workers' accommodation.
Just looking at top of page 19, section 42A report, where you're recommending alterations to policy 6315. Wondering whether that policy, as you've redrafted it, is consistent with the application of the urban growth boundaries.
Now, do you mean provisions that either implement or would maintain urban growth boundaries? Or?
I understood that the point of the urban growth boundaries is that those were the boundaries within which urban development occurred. Therefore, urban development would not be occurring in the rural zone. But you seem to be writing a policy that says you can have urban development in the urban zone as long as it doesn't degrade OELs and OELs, has capacity to absorb change. That seems to be contrary to the urban growth boundary provisions. I may be wrong.
So the policy has notified most urban subdivision and development.
This one.
Sorry, to avoid 631. The policy has notified most avoid urban subdivision and development in the rural zones, which is clearly accords with an urban growth boundary framework.
Yes, that's your change.
It's changed to. Yes, it's become, but it's because it says rural zones, it's actually contemplating urban development in those zones. So what I wouldn't say that the policy's inconsistent, but I would say that the policy could be applied for plan changes that would seek to change the location of the urban growth boundary.
Wouldn't the plan change still comply with policy 6315 if the plan change involved changing the zone to the residential zone and moving the urban growth boundary, because then it wouldn't be occurring in a rural zone. And isn't that the sort of plan change that the council would be expecting from the way the plan has been prepared?
I don't disagree with you, sir. I'm just looking at the policy now to see if it offers any further added value than the policy underneath it. Which it doesn't seem to. So in hindsight, perhaps I was by some of those submissions.
That's fine.
Except perhaps that it does give the message that is avoidance before and over, because 6315 is in your change one, revised, enabling rural life living through the growth where landscape can accommodate change, doesn't actually give the message that the general message is to not.
That's 6315.
Well, the first limb, is avoid degradation of the outstanding natural features and landscapes. In a broader sense, if looking, turning to policy, the policy underneath it, it wouldn't, if that was the case, it wouldn't have capacity to absorb change. So I'm just conscious there, I'm just looking critically at it and seeing what added value it offers.
You're trying to talk about that in your right-hand column, aren't you? Effectiveness and efficiency. You start to introduce rural living into the belt.
Thanks.
We move on to the next one then, which is on page 20, where you are proposing an amendment to policy 6316, which is in the modified version, by adding resort zones and changes. Isn't that an encouragement for further special zones called resort zones?
I have seen some evidence, sir, that seeks special zones are included. I'm reluctant to do so because we're trying to reduce the amount of special zones.
There is no zone called resort zone, particularly. They actually are special zones which have resort in the name, such as the Norbert Resort Zones and the Jack's Point Resort Zone. There isn't a There's not a section of zones in the proposed district plan called resort zones. There's a section called special zones. Is that correct?
Yes, it's still called special zones.
And some of them are called resort zones.
So I'm just wondering
whether that is really just asking for a special zone when the intention is that rural living and rural residential be the options for that sort of living.
Well, no, I do accept that the policy is originally modified, discounted resort-style living, places like Millbrook where they have a mix of activities. Is your trouble with the phrasing and that it doesn't directly relate to other zones that are contemplated, or the actual activities that would stem from including that?
No, I'm more interested in the consequences in terms of private plan changes. Is there a particular form of development that you consider should be enabled that could not occur under the rural lifestyle or rural residential zone and requires special provisions?
Yes, tourism, commercial activities and commercial tourism aren't contemplated in the rural lifestyle and rural residential zones.
Perhaps then, given that terminology, might be more specific as to what is intended rather than just the term resort zones, because resort zones means I will apply for private plan change for the Kawea Flat Resort Zone, irrespective of what is, whether it's tourism, etc. or not.
Yes, I accept that. I also...
Is it perhaps better dealt with a separate policy? There are submissions seeking that sort of thing. It may be that a separate policy directed to those tourism-focused...
Yes, the original intent of the policy is to acknowledge that people will seek rural living, but to actually encourage them to use existing...
Zones.
And not to apply for new special zones somewhere and advisor that the existing framework doesn't support that for some reason.
Maybe the policy should be sufficiently explicit to say just what you've told us. But, I mean, that's the point of policies. They should actually tell us that, not leave it for us to guess by implication in 5 years' time. But
while it's fresh in your mind, can you just say what you said again so I can write it down?
Little change there, but the intention was to encourage proponents to use the rural lifestyle and rural residential zones because they are existing zones in the district plan, and to discourage proponents from devising special zones with bespoke provisions. On the back of that conversation, I accept that it might be best to keep that policy specific to encouraging those two zones and to apply some consideration for other types of activities without trying to pigeonhole them.
Yes, I think you did say something earlier about there was some need to make or to encourage tourist-related activities and accommodation into areas that can accommodate change. But I can't recall your exact wording, but it was something along that lines, wasn't it? And that was why you included resort zone, but that may not have been specific enough. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
You say the table on the importance of tourism, so far that recognises for resort activities and the importance of tourism and commercial recreation based activities.
Yes, was that in the table, that the evaluation of changing that policy?
Yeah, that was in your explanation of the effectiveness and efficiency of adding resort zone.
Yes, that's just a box.
Now, I think, for instance, you have as the benefits. Likely to encourage these types of activities and service through plan changes, I think that you're better off to have a policy which actually says that than explicitly that specific one off should be through plan changes.
Six 3 1 8. This is in the notified version. I'm just wondering whether there shouldn't be some recognition of the need for navigation lights, both on the lakes, and for the airport. That seems to suggest no lights should be visible from above or a distance. Navigation lights, for obvious reasons, have to be seen in those ways.
Have you read the evidence from Real Journeys, sir?
From?
Real Journeys?
No.
They claim that I misinterpreted their submission, which could have happened because it showed annotated text and didn't give a justification for it, and I took their changes along the same thread that you did, but the submission and my response was that that can be dealt with by the mechanisms, but their response and their evidence is that it's the glare from lights on land that can be a safety hazard.
Yes, I recognise that.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering whether this is...
I doubt to whether these activities to install essential infrastructure would state.
Well, yes, because all the navigation lights on the lake are on ONLs and ONFs. They're on structures.
Well, I'd like to check the utilities chapter to see if there's any dispensations for them, but...
I mean, I was just wondering if you've given thought to that.
There's a question of if it's cut off, can you actually put controls on its navigation lights so that they're on during the time that they're
about moving? No, you have to leave them on. Well, certainly on lakes.
But you know, I know for lakes, I'm talking about more airports.
Oh, the airports tend to turn them off because they use a hell of a lot of that.
Chairman, while you're on that policy, could I refer Mr. Bahar to another aspect of it? The criticism in Real Journeys is partly a legal criticism that your suggested change is out of scope, but it's also a criticism or an argument that you've lost the essential point and changed the focus of the policy from the adverse effects of glare on visual amenity to quite different considerations. Whether you move to the quite different considerations is one question. That's the scope issue that they're arguing. I've already asked counsel for the council about that one. But the question is, there is now no provision for addressing glare effects as a visual amenity issue. Do you think their concern is well founded on reflection, or you?
Not really, sir, because it's inherent that lights can cause glare, and if an impact is the degradation of the night sky.
I think their specific submission point was glare as an adverse effect on the neighbours, as opposed to the night sky.
My point in this higher order chapter is that it's the wider impact of glare lighting on the night sky from... It wouldn't be a neighbour effect. And there are also... I might have also identified in my first way report that there are rules in almost in every zone, certainly the rural zones, to glare. So I think that neighbour to neighbour, local issue is dealt with. This policy is more intended for where a development might be contemplated in a remote location, and you can do as you're aware, sir, if you do your best to mitigate it with colours and design, but at night if they turn the lights on and you can see it from 10 kilometres away.
No, that's okay. You gave me a chance to check that I needed to ask the next five questions, and I didn't. But the final question I have for you is to do with provision 6413. And I'm just wondering if there's confusion in terminology. We've got the rural zone, and then we refer to the rural zones. But it's very confusing as to what is in and what is out of the rural zones. For instance, the Gibson Character Zone, I think, has been treated as a rural zone, but it's not, doesn't have rural in the title. And I know that the framework for the plan had a urban and a rural. I'm just wondering if something...
Thank you, sir. I think potentially an easier correction would be that if it said the landscape assessment matters in part 21.7 only apply to the rural zone, being the rural zone.
Any rural zone.
Yes. clarification purposes do not apply to the following areas within the rural zone.
Or maybe just the following zones.
Following zones. Well, the ski areas...
And areas within the rural zone. Yeah.
Yes. And the main confusion there is that the ski area subzones are a subset within the rural zone. Rankin Arm is zone rural in the rural zone. The Gibson Character Zone is its separate zone. And it has assessment matters in it, in that zone. So that was... Thanks for bringing it to my attention, sir. And the rural lifestyle zone and the rural residential zones are separate zones. They would not need to be there, but the intent was to provide clarification, particularly to lay people who want to know whether or not if the assessment matters apply to activities. And also when you look at proposed district land maps, you've got this rural landscape and there's zones inside it. The landscape affects the rural zone, but within that contained area, there's the rural residential zone, rural lifestyle zone.
So I wanted to check this because it was raised in relation to this. So it goes across several maps, not going to find the maps. Mount Iron is one example where the ONF seems to extend outside of the rural zone into the large lot. It's sort of unclear.
And what going there, sir? 18?
8 and 21. 18, is that the bigger one? 18. Maybe it's just unclear, but it may be they line up.
They.
What's the boundary to the large lot zone? But on 21, for example, the ONF runs into the residential zone, the low density residential zone.
Yes, it does. That's. That's a cartographic issue.
And so that shouldn't do that, is that?
No. Effectively, well, the rural zone, the assessment matters in the landscape classifications apply to the rural zone.
Okay. And then we get on map 27, Feely Hill, which is divided between the rural zone and the special zone. So is the ONF classification excluded from the special zone portion?
It would be in terms of the provisions, this map would in terms of the intention of the provision then, as I think drafted the landscape classification, then the assessment matters wouldn't apply because they're in the rural zone. With regard to the mapping, that's something.
Yes, no, and that's the following question then. Are the ONL and ONF lines in the district plan lines there for the management of the plan provisions, or are they there landscape architects think they are the beginning and ending of those areas.
I think the latter at this stage, sir, but I would be comfortable.
Which do you think is preferable? I think the former.
I think that from an administrative point of view, the landscape lines should stick to the zone they apply. From an overarching landscape management point of view, it does provide assistance to know that's where that is, landscape, that's where that, because it's the mind of landscape architect, the landscape doesn't change when the zone changes, but in reality, it's in the district plan administration where it does. But if there's a zoning change and the provisions will manage the values of that resource within it, and I think that's the same as the operative district plan, at least in terms of the application of the assessment matters.
Just one or two. Commissioner Sinclair still has his point by point, blow by blow issue. I have a general question for you, Mr. Barr. One of the criticisms that some of the submitters have made is that your Section 32 analysis does not acknowledge or not sufficiently acknowledge the sunk cost the community has and all of the litigation over the last 15 years interpreting and applying the ODP provisions. And in effect, by creating a new framework, you're setting the community up for another round of multiple Environment Court appeals. Now, what's your response to that? Firstly, as a criticism of your Section 32 report, and secondly, in terms of the merits of the point.
Or contemplated the impacts of the change in terms of the legacy that's gone before it. But what is in the Section 32 and what I do think reconciles that is that the provisions in the proposed district plan landscape chapter and landscape provisions in the rural zone are fundamentally based on the best parts of the operative district plan to be effective at managing the landscape resource. Let's cut out the rust, sir. It's tried to demystify and make more efficient the administration. And not efficient to make decisions, to enable development and make that easier for people, but simply to get on with looking at the merits of whatever the case is.
Thank you for that. Can I take you, please, to section 631, the objective in your recommended revised version?
Before you ask about the objective, sir, it is under the knife at the moment. That's the direction to...
Good point. I'll merely say the question I was going to ask you was, do we need more clarification as to what inappropriate subdivision and development is in the context of rural landscapes? So
yes, and I'm aware of those submissions, and that question might like Oasis.
No, we like it.
There's been a request that you have that before you need to consider the other submissions, so by the end of today I'll be filing that to legal counsel.
Good answer.
Hmm?
Go to policy 6311. This is an aspect of the point you were discussing with the chair. The implication of 6311 is that the ONFs are all in the rural zone, which, as we've just discussed, is not the case. That, accepting that with Mount Iron, that may be a mapping glitch, but clearly on the face of the Arrowtown map, there's a substantial chunk of Ferry Hill on the special zone. Does that suggest a need to further redrafting of 6311?
No, because if there's any changes that I'd like to think they'd be in the mapping circuit.
So you're going to cut Ferry Hill in half?
If that's what the planning framework has done, then that's what the provisions, that's what the map annotations should acknowledge. If there's no... No, I like the same thing.
And... Similarly, I think Jack's point is another one you might care to look at. So your answer is the solutions in the mapping.
Yes, sir.
The mapping lines. 6314, using the nomenclature in your recommended revised version. Can you explain to me what an urban subdivision is?
But we have a definition of urban development that's currently being contemplated as well, so perhaps it could be modified to reflect that definition, which would be consistent with the urban development chapter.
I think I asked Council for the Council to have a look at that definition of urban development, so... with all due respect, it's not entirely clear as to what that means. Now, going to your 6315, the question I have for you, at the moment, this is framed, as I read it, as sequential inquiry. First, an inquiry, can the landscape accommodate change in the area proposed? Secondly, you're going to enable lifestyle living in those areas. My question is, does there need to be a sense that you're enabling it to the extent that the landscape can accommodate change? Because at the moment, it's like, to be clear what I'm getting at, it seems to be a tick the box. Tick box A, move to outcome B.
So, sir, just to clarify, tick box A and B.
You've established that the landscape can accommodate some change. Policy says you are then going to enable lifestyle living in that area.
Well, whether or not the landscape had capacity to absorb change would need to be subject to the scrutiny of the provisions in the rural zone and the other policy framework. So I'm quite comfortable with it.
So your answer, I think, is that it, the point that is at the kernel of my question is addressed in other policies. Tell me which ones.
Well, it would depend on the classification the site was in. So I can take a pick. There'd be quite a lot, sir.
Well, there's a lot that we'll move on, and I'll have another look at it myself. Commissioner Sinclair suggested that I take the bull by the horns and suggest some alternative words for your consideration. The sort of thing I had in mind was enable rural living through applying rural landscape, rural residential and resort zones, assuming that stays, but plan changes in areas where the landscape can accommodate change. And to the extent that change, to the extent of that change, or that capacity to absorb, I'm making it up on the fly.
To the extent that it can?
To the extent that it can accommodate change. But that's the concept. So, as I say, can I invite you to think about that?
So there's where there's some capacity, but only to the extent of the capacity to accommodate change, rather than an unlimited amount of change once you've determined that you can have some. That, I think, is that the number?
That's the number. I couldn't draft it quick enough with my friends sitting there thinking about it. Next point, 6.3.1.11. The concept, with particular regard to values relating to, and then there's a list. This is, of course, a subset of the Pigeon Bay criteria. And the question for you is why these ones are not other values that Pigeon Bay identifies.
Feature might have neither of those, but might be very precious to the geologic society. Same for historic elements and the matters of cultural and spiritual value to Tangata Whenua. We may not even know what they are.
And in that latter point, you said including Tōpuni, something we discussed yesterday with the Tangata Whenua witnesses. Is that Tōpuni as mapped? Or even Tōpuni.
Right now?
Right now.
Any, because you don't know what those values are.
Well, in that case, I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Pickard yesterday. If you don't know where they are, how are you able to assess the costs in terms of Section 32? Of imposing that obligation.
You don't know where they are, sir. You wouldn't be able to notify an application on that basis in the context of a resource consent application without knowing. Of course, the only inference we have at the moment is the statutory acknowledgement hearings. A significant portion of non-farming development in the rural zone is notified. And I think there are ample opportunities through the public notification, putting aside any consultation that proponents may have undertaken in that process.
Thank you. Can I ask you to go to, here's another objective. I have one, I don't think this is a drafting, well, it is a drafting point. 632 refers to amenity values. Should that be amenity values or visual amenity values in this context?
Context of you receiving an updated version of those objectives and looking at what I've gotten scribbled in front of me, I don't think that question is very relevant because it's an objective, it's a question about the objective.
Yep.
And the objective is going to change soon.
All right, think about that along the way. 6322. I think we've already had a go at this. This is the question I asked Dr. Reed, which is it correct English and is it what the policy is directed at to talk about degrading landscape character or are you talking about changing it?
No, it's talking about degrading.
Which she said would be something significant, basically which jarred with the existing character. That's the underlying intention. When you use degrading in that context, that's what you mean.
It's lower the rank of quality.
It's not. In the context of character, how do you lower character?
Because character is an element of landscape, and that is a resource that needs to be appreciated as part of the wider landscape, amenity value, landscape value.
But you're in the context of degrading landscape character, you're using it in the same sense as Dr. Reed of something that jars with that character. Or are you, thank you. That's just what I want to make sure that the technical evidence and the planning evidence aligns. That's all I'm getting at. Now, in the other question in that context is, do we need a sense of scale? We're talking about the district's landscape character and visual amenity would not be degraded. Is that a district-wide assessment? Is it a locality assessment? Is it a site-by-site assessment?
It would be the site-by-site assessment, but it's in the context of adverse effects from the combination from cumulative developments.
Now, 6323, we didn't see a seek support from. What do you mean? Is this an existing environment type argument, or is it something else?
Not in a strict sense necessarily. It's justification that one more development is okay because there's already a node of development there. So what's the harm in one more?
I think that's what I would term an existing environment argument. A baseline. So I'm clear what you mean.
Includes, in the analysis that would be undertaken, it would include intensive but unimplemented development as well?
That's right. Within the definition of existing environment includes consented developments that are likely to occur.
Yeah, thank you. I threw that qualifier in just in case I was wrong, sir.
Are ye of little faith? Now, in your review of objectives, think about whether 633 overlaps and duplicates with 631, because both deal with ONFs. As I say, no more